I hope you listen to that. We are right now in the midst of a world filled with human suffering. And I don't know about you, but this question has been asked ever since the beginning, especially those who go against God or don't believe in God. They always ask that question, why would a loving God allow for suffering? So it's a huge problem. It's a huge problem to understand. It's a huge problem to take up. I'm going to try to do it in a couple of sessions here through Lamentations, but hopefully you guys can understand. And hopefully you guys see the reality of and the relevance of this book, because just look around us. Last night was human suffering. If you were driving last night, that was scary. If you have to shovel your driveway this morning, suffering. If you look at the people in Taal region, they're suffering. Not just them. Animals are suffering. Plant life is suffering. Everything's suffering. Australia, they're suffering all over the place. Why? We're going to try to take that up through the book of Lamentations. So if you weren't here last week, we started study of Lamentations. If you missed it, you can go to YouTube or you can go to our Facebook page to watch it. It was an intro to the book. And really, the gist of the message last week was that why I picked this book to begin with. And the reason that I gave you guys why I picked this book to begin with for us to study is simple. It's the fact that all human beings will experience suffering in this crazy, broken world. This is why we should study the book of Lamentations, because ultimately, this book is an attempt to reflect on the meaning of suffering and God's role in it. We can't let suffering take our faith away. We can't let suffering change the way we view God, because suffering was allowed by God for a purpose. And we're going to take that up, hopefully, as we go along. Our study of this book. One commentary says that Lamentations is a theodicy, or an attempt to explain the ways of God to humanity, especially when it comes to suffering. And much like the book of Job, the book of Job is the same thing, right? It's an attempt to explain God's ways to humanity in the midst of suffering. However, the book of Job is different. It's a different kind of suffering than the book of Lamentations presents to us. The book of Job is a study or deals with the problem of personal suffering. Right? It was Job who suffered, and Job alone who suffered. His wife was taken, or not his wife, but his children were taken away, all his belongings were taken away. Sadly, his wife was not taken away. It added into his suffering. All right? It added on to his suffering, his wife. But as personal suffering, it was only Job who was suffering. Lamentations, on the other hand, deals with the problem of national suffering. It was the people of Jerusalem. It was the Israelites, the people of Judah who suffered. And the city of Jerusalem suffered. So it was that's one of the differences between the book of Job and the suffering it presents and the book of Lamentations and the suffering it presents. Another difference between Job and Lamentations is that the sufferings that Job experienced were undeserved. He wasn't doing anything. He was just doing what God told him to do. And God, because he was doing what God told him to do, pretty much, put him up against Satan's challenge, right? I have one guy, God said, right? His name is Job. Oh, no. Satan said, you have a guy, right? Job. Only reason why he's not suffering is because, you're protecting him. And God said, no. Even if I took my hand of protection off, Job would not. His faith would remain, right? And even got stronger. So Job's suffering was undeserved. Meanwhile, the sufferings that Jeremiah laments were justly deserved. Right? We're going to see that as we take up this first 11 verses. And this is where the problem of human suffering comes in. Just like what I said last week, The problem of human suffering in the context of Lamentations, where the suffering is justly deserved, the problem with that is, how do we understand that and see that kind of suffering as loving? How do we see a justly deserved suffering, like we're going to see in Lamentations, as a loving act from a merciful God? Again, I believe as we study Lamentations, we're going to slowly answer that question. Because it's hard to see, right? Suffering blinds us from the goodness of God. You agree with that? For a lot of us, suffering blinds us from the goodness of God. But that's not what suffering is supposed to do, especially for those of us who believe that God is good and He is good all the time. Right? So hopefully that's what we're going to learn as we study this book. So as we begin our study of this book, I'm just going to give you first some observations about the book. Okay? So I want you guys to open the book, Lamentations. You know where it's at, right? After the book of Jeremiah, right? Okay? Open up the book. I'm just going to give you some observations. I want you guys to see what I'm talking about here. Okay? If you have it on your phones, go to your phones. So the book of Lamentations contains five laments, five chapters. Each chapter is a lament. It's a poem, or just like what I said last week, it's a song. It's a breakup song. Remember last week? Okay. We're not going to sing any more songs today. That was last week. So five laments, five poems, or five songs. The prophet, Jeremiah, or the weeping prophet, is believed to be the writer, although some people say that the writer is anonymous. Nobody knows, but there's more evidence that says it's Jeremiah. And is lamenting the siege of Jerusalem in 586 B.C. Now, each chapter contains how many verses? Look at your books. 22, right? 22 verses except for chapter 3, which contains 66. 66 divisible by 22? Yes, right? So what's the significance of the 22? Okay, why is all the verses divided into 20, or why are all the chapters have 22 verses and chapter 3 has 3 times 22 verses? Why is that so significant? The significance is that the 22 verses represents the Hebrew alphabet. Each verse in these chapters begins with a letter from the Hebrew alphabet. It's called an acrostic, right? So if it was our alphabet, verse 1 will begin with a letter A, verse 2 will begin with a letter B, C, D, E, and so on and so forth. So Lamentations is like that. It is written like that. It is written as an acrostic. But only chapters 1, 2, and 4 are written like that. Okay? 1, 2, and 4, 22 verses per chapter, is written as an acrostic, okay? Chapter 3 is in acrostic form, but it's 3 times 22. So it repeats the alphabet 3 times. I wonder what he's talking about in chapter 3. Why would he have to repeat the alphabet 3 times? And then chapter 5 has 22 verses, but it is not written as an acrostic. It is just written as a regular chapter with a regular, it's a regular prayer, as we're going to see later on. So we can divide Lamentations like that, okay? 22 verses representing the alphabet of the Hebrew alphabet for chapters 1, 2, and 4. Chapter 3, 3 times the acrostic. Chapter 5, no acrostic, okay? We can also divide these chapters by topic as well, okay? Each topic starts with the letter P, so it's easy to remember, okay? Main topic of chapter 1 is the place. Mostly chapter 1 talks about the place, Jerusalem. Chapter 2 talks about the punishment. Chapter 3 talks about the prophet who wrote this and the promise. That's why there's 3. Okay? Chapter 4 talks about the people, and chapter 5 talks about prayer. Okay? So that's how this book is arranged. This book of songs is arranged. Okay, so this morning we're going to focus on chapter 1, lament for the place, or lament for Jerusalem. Now, if you look at chapter 1, it's divided into two parts. Okay? 22 divided by 11 equals? 22 divided by 11 equals 10. Whoa. 22 divided by 11 equals 2. Where are we at? Can we? So 22 divided by 11 equals 2. There's two parts to chapter 1. The first part, if you read it, it is spoken by the prophet. And then the second part is spoken by somebody else. So the first 11 chapters is by the prophet. The last 11 chapters is by somebody else, a female somebody, who is portrayed as who's portraying Jerusalem. So male voice at the start, female voice at the end. So if we were to compare this to a song, this would be a duet. Male and female. Like the guy in America's Got Talent, he can sing both, right? The Filipino guy, what's his name? Huh? Marcelito Pomoy. Right? He sings duets by himself. That's what we're going to do in chapter 1. It's a duet. First 11 verses, male. Last 11 verses is female. Okay? So let's do that. Let's start with the first 11 verses of chapter 1. I'm going to start by showing you a picture. Okay? I don't know if we can zoom into that picture, but we're going to zoom in later. Okay? That sculpture was carved by William Wetmore Story. And it's currently housed in the galleries of Philadelphia's Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts. So it's, if you want to go see it, go to Pennsylvania's Academy of Fine Arts. You'll see it there. The inscription at the base of the throne says, Jerusalem in her desolation. So the artist who carved this is doing what Jeremiah is doing here in Lamentations. He's likening Jerusalem to a woman, to a queen. Okay, in this sense, because she's sitting on a throne. You can see that, right? She's sitting on a throne, and you can see her face. I don't know if you guys can see it clearly, but she's not really smiling. She's sad. You see it, right? Jerusalem in her desolation. One commentary describes this sculpture as this. The queenly city William Story carved into stone is Jerusalem personified. The Jerusalem that barely survived the tragic events described at the end of the book of Jeremiah. Story's sculpture depicts the aftermath, a city still numb with grief. The crumbled bits of mortar around her suggest a city in ruins. Yet, the most significant detail is the tiny serpent slithering near the queen's feet. You can't see it. If we can zoom in, can we zoom into that? By the feet? No? There's a little snake slithering by the feet. I don't know if I can point it out to you, but it's right there. You see the shadow a little bit, but there's a little snake slithering by her feet, and that's very significant because that serpent stands for sin. Right? It stands for sin, showing that Jerusalem's desolation was the result of her disobedience. Right? So remember that picture? And picture that in your head as we read the description of it in Lamentations 1, 1 to 11. Let's start with verse 1. How lonely sits the city that was full of people. How like a widow has she become. She who was great among nations. She who was a princess among the provinces has become a slave. What's happening here? What's the focus here of this first verse? The focus of this verse is the transformation that happened to Jerusalem, who was once a princess, a city full of people, but now has become a widow, describing the feeling of grief and pain of a woman losing her husband. Okay? I don't know who of you have gone through that. That's very painful, right? If you lost your husband, your partner. So that's how Jeremiah decides to describe it. She's like a city full of people. She's like a widow. This is his way of describing his pain. Okay? And from a princess, Jerusalem has become what? slave. Again, describing Jerusalem's fall in terms of her position. So what is Jeremiah doing here to describe his pain? He's contrasting good times from the bad. Right? And when you think about it, people in grief always do that. You always contrast the good from the bad. If you're grieving, you always try to remember the good, because that's going to help you overcome grief. But somehow, it doesn't. Sometimes it gets you deeper into grief, because when you see the present and then you look at the past, what happened? How did this happen? But again, what Jeremiah is doing here is he's showing us the depth of his sorrow that he's feeling at this point. Just imagine Jeremiah just sitting in the middle of Jerusalem, everything's destroyed. Then he starts to remember, oh yeah, that's where the temple used to be. Oh yeah, that's where, you know, we used to play as kids, or that's where we, right? Imagine his grief at that point, right? It would have been probably easier for Jeremiah to just accept Jerusalem's current state if Jerusalem was always desolate. If Jerusalem was always in ruins, that they never went through some good times, it would have been easier to accept, right? But because they went through some good times and then all of a sudden fell from such great heights, and they fell fast and they fell hard, Jeremiah's suffering and sorrow is just is multiplied. And it's a bitter pill to swallow for Jeremiah. So I think that's what he's trying to communicate there in that verse. Let's go to verse 2. She weeps bitterly in the night with tears on her cheeks. Among all her lovers, she has none to comfort her. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They have become her enemies. Again, contrast from before. She had lovers. She had friends. Now, her lovers are nowhere to be found. And her friends have become her enemies. We're not going to take up much of this verse because this verse is unpacked more in the last 11 verses of chapter 1. So we're going to do it then. Okay? Let's go. 3-6. Judah has gone into exile because of affliction and hard servitude. And she dwells now among the nations, but finds no resting place. Her pursuers have all overtaken her in the midst of her distress. The roads to Zion mourn, for none come to the festival. All her gates are desolate. Her priests groan. Her virgins have been afflicted, and she herself suffers bitterly. 5, her foes have become the head. Her enemies prosper because the Lord has afflicted her for the multitude of her transgressions. Her children have gone away, captives before the foe. Verse 6, the daughter of Zion, all her majesty has departed. Her princes have become like deer that find no pasture. They fled without strength before the pursuers. So what's Jeremiah doing in these 3 verses? So after using poetry and imagery in the first two verses, Jeremiah all of a sudden becomes a reporter in the next 3 verses, 3-6. All he's doing here is citing and describing facts about the current state of his beloved city, right? There is no imagery, there is no poetry. He's just telling us straight facts. Jerusalem was conquered and taken captive. Straight facts. The once busy city is now desolate and empty. Straight facts. Meanwhile, all her enemies are prospering. Straight facts. Became a reporter. One commentator writes this. The routes to Jerusalem once thronged with pilgrims going up to the temple to participate in festal rites are now completely deserted. It is like the experience we had when we went to Rome. When we went through the ruins of Rome, and you imagine how great Rome was, and all the things that made Rome great, all the signs of Rome's greatness still standing but in ruins, like the Colosseum, the Forum, all those are signs of the greatness of Rome. And you get there and you're thinking, wow, Rome must have been really great, but now everything that's left is ruins. The more they dig, the more they find ruins. But the more ruins you find, the more idea you have of how great Rome was. Right? And it's sad walking through Rome. They used to be conquerors. They used to rule, a third or more than a third of the world? Now they're in ruins. And in verse 5, Jeremiah states the most painful fact about the desolation of Jerusalem. What does verse 5 say? Her foes have become the head, her enemies prosper. Why? Because the Lord has afflicted her. Why? For the multitude of her transgressions. That must really hurt to say, right? For Jeremiah? Right? Like for me, I wouldn't think twice of saying that. Because I would have been, I told you so. Right? I told you so. I told you before. But notice that about Jeremiah, right? Jeremiah never said, I told you so. He never said that. He's just weeping. He's sympathetic over what happened to Jerusalem, even though it was really their fault. That's why it happened. That's why I'm saying, while I'm reading this, I'm like, how does Jeremiah do that? Because I'd be like, yeah, look where you're at now. I've been telling you for years to stop doing what you're doing. You didn't stop. Now look where you're at. I have no sympathy. That's what I'm trying to say. And it's not, like, one thing I learned from here is to have sympathy. You know what I'm saying? Even though you are the prophet that I kind of warned these people, you should still have sympathy for them at their time of desolation, even though really it's their fault. Right? You should have sympathy, even though it's their fault. So that's what happened. How did she get afflicted? How did her foes become her head? How did her enemies prosper? Because of her multitude of transgressions. Right? Her multitude of transgressions. And again, that must be really hard to say for Jeremiah because he knows that Jerusalem's state was not because of human cruelty or fate, but because Judah has sinned against the Almighty God. And not just once or twice. They have been deliberately sinning. Some commentaries say that they have been rebelling for years. So they heard what Jeremiah said. They heard the warnings. They ignored it and kept doing their own thing. Right? Through the multiple warnings coming from God through Jeremiah, the people didn't listen. They didn't think that God would actually go through with the threats of punishment that Jeremiah warned them about. How many times did Jeremiah warn them? Check it out. Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 18. What does it say? And now what do you gain by going to Egypt to drink the waters of the Nile? Or what do you gain by going to Assyria to drink the waters of the Euphrates? Because Jerusalem was partnering with Egypt and Assyria. Check out verse 36. How much you go about charging your way, you shall be put to shame by who? Egypt, as you were put to shame by Assyria, 37. From it too you will come away with your hands on your head, for the Lord has rejected those in whom you trust. And you will not prosper by them. What was the warning? Stop trusting these nations. Trust in God. Well, what did they do? They partnered with Egypt and Assyria. But when the desolation came, these were the ones who pillaged and raped them as well, right? So it's a failed alliance with Egypt and Assyria. Chapter 4, verse 16 and 17. Warn the nations that he is coming, announce to Jerusalem, besiegers come from a distant land. They shout against the cities of Judah. 17. Like keepers of a field are they against her all around because she has rebelled against me. Talking about the siege that will happen. Okay? Somebody will come from outside of the land and besiege you. Did they listen? No. And why are they doing that? Why are these people coming to besiege her? because they rebelled against the Lord. Chapter 5, verse 17. Can you guys read it? It shall eat up your sons and your... Remember what a siege is? Remember what a siege looks like? When a city is at siege, they surround whoever the attacking army is. They surround the city so that nobody can come out and nothing can get in until you run out of food. They starve you to death. And that's what it's talking about there, right? They're going to eat up all your food. They're going to eat up all your sons and daughters. All your flocks. You're going to be starving. There's going to be a famine because of the siege that is coming. These were all warnings. Nobody listened. Chapter 7, 12 to 16. You guys read it. Who's asked for you? Jeremiah. God tells Jeremiah, stop praying for these guys. I'm not going to listen to you. They're going to get what they deserve. See that? If you were warned like that, would you listen? Yeah, I would listen. Because when I was a kid, I was warned like that. Don't touch the dad. No. They'll touch it. But that's how we are, right? As people. You know how many warnings we send out every Sunday? Stop neglecting your spiritual growth. Come to Wednesday prayer. Anybody come to Wednesday? Still the same people. Noah's time. How many times did Noah warn everybody about the flood? The whole time he was building the ark. Come on. Nobody listened. These guys, nobody listened. You think God is bluffing? I think that's what they were thinking, right? That God is just bluffing. He's not going to do it. He's a loving God. Not going to do it. Mm. 734. And I will silence in the cities of Judah. No more parties. Stop partying. I'm going to silence all these parties. There's no enjoyment that's going to be had in Jerusalem. That's what basically that said. No more feasts, festivals. Forget all that. You don't deserve to be happy. And this is God talking to Jeremiah. Last one, 9, 15 to 16 in Jeremiah. And again, this is why I said earlier, it's so hard to see a loving God in the midst of all these threats. There's so much threats in Jeremiah, right? That last one is talking about their long exile. I'm not going to stop until I've consumed all of you. Would a loving God do that? What does that say about God, right? You know those, I've always heard this too from other people, like those people who, if you know somebody who takes long to get angry, like just, I've never seen them angry. Those are the ones that when they do get angry are very scary. Yeah. Like Kuya Alvin, I've never seen angry. Who else? No, I don't want to see Ate Rose angry. I want to see you angry. I haven't seen Kuya Mike. I've never seen angry. Kuya G, I've never really seen angry. Those are the people that when you see angry, when they do get angry, right? What did the Hulk say? You won't like me when I'm angry. Because God, in the Bible it says God is slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love. That's why people always think, oh, he's not going to do it. He's abounding in steadfast love. No, you forgot the first part. He's slow to anger. It doesn't mean he's not going to get angry. But when he does, it's scary, right? It's scary. That's why earlier when I said that Jerusalem's suffering is justly deserved, it's because they have been warned multiple times. They did not listen. They openly rebelled against God despite the warnings. So the Lord, who is ever faithful to his word, did according to his word. He has to. He can't say, yeah, even though I warned you for the past 5 generations, because you look so, you know, akaawa na may itsura nyo, okay, I'll change my mind. He doesn't do that. Doesn't matter how much begging you do. When the time comes when God says, I'm going to do this, he will do it. He will do it. Let's go back to Lamentations 7 to 11. Jerusalem remembers in the days of her affliction and wandering all the precious things that were hers. From days of old, when her people fell into the hand of the foe and there was none to help her, her foes gloated over her. They mocked her downfall. 8. Jerusalem sinned grievously. Therefore she became what? Filthy. All who honored her despise her, for they have seen her nakedness. She herself groans and turns her face away. 9. No, 9. Her uncleanness was in her skirts. She took no thought of their future. Therefore, her fall is terrible. She has no comforter. Oh, Lord, behold my affliction, for the enemy has triumphed. 10. The enemy has stretched out his hands over all her precious things, for she has seen the nations enter her sanctuary, those whom you forbade to enter your congregation. And last verse, all her people groan as they search for bread. They trade their treasures for food to revive their strength. Look, O Lord, and see, for I am despised. See what happened? Even her people are like begging for food just to revive their... They trade money for food to revive their strength. In verse 8, we see Jeremiah's second confession of the sin of Jerusalem, right? Verse 8 says, Jerusalem sinned grievously. Therefore, she became filthy. Right? Jeremiah is reminding us that God is not a cruel, unjust God. Why would he say that Jerusalem sinned twice? To remind us that God is not cruel. He's not unjust. His anger is fierce, but it is a just anger because of Jerusalem's rebellion against him. Right? He's not cruel, but when you read the warnings in Jeremiah, it sounds like he's a cruel God. But if Jerusalem followed, what would happen? They would have been okay. But they didn't, right? The prophet goes out as far as to compare Jerusalem to a harlot or a prostitute. shamelessly exposing her nakedness even while in her menstrual period. How dirty that is to the Jews. Very dirty. It's got blood. Strong words that give us a strong image of Jerusalem's rebellion against God. But I think the worst part is the second phrase in verse 9. Let's check out verse 9 again. It says, her uncleanness was in her skirts. She took no thought of her future. I think that's the worst part. She took no thought of her future. And again, it brings me back to the message I delivered on the last Sunday of last year. Remember that message? On the last Sunday of the year 2019, the message was entitled what? Prioritizing your priorities, right? Remember? Haggai was the book that we were studying. Haggai challenged us to what? Consider our ways. Take thought of your future. Now, how many of you have considered prioritizing your spiritual growth? After that message. Seriously. Has anything changed after you heard that message? How much sense of urgency do you have now when it comes to your growth spiritually? Because Jerusalem, she didn't even think about it. She just kept doing what she was doing. Not thinking about consequences. Not thinking about penalties. Not thinking about her future. She took no thought of her future. It's like, I don't know if you guys watch stand-up comedy. I watch a lot of that stuff. I know I shouldn't, but it's funny. Kevin Hart, you know Kevin Hart? Once he described his father as, his father went out with no pockets. I don't know if you guys remember this part. His father went out with no pockets, nothing. And he says, if you see someone go out with no pockets, that person doesn't care about his life. I'm like, why? Because if you don't have a bag, where would you put your ID? Your pocket. Where would you put money? Your pocket. Keys. Pocket. If you don't have a bag, right? If you don't have any pockets, you don't have any money, you don't care if you're going to eat or starve or whatever. You don't care about your house to get back in, to lock it even. You have no keys. You care about your car. You don't care about anything. You're not thinking about your future. Whatever happens to me with no pockets, whatever. That's it. If you get run over by a bus and you have no pockets and you have no ID, who's going to claim you? Right? Jerusalem is like that. She was doing all these things, showing her blood and her skirt, like the way it's described here, as a harlot. Not even thinking about her future. Right? How hopeless can you be? Like how way off can you be if you have no thought of future? Like young people. Who here is thinking about 2 years from now? Am I going to get a job? Can I help my parents, at least pay something at home and or you just go with the flow? No, because I know a lot of young people like that. Just go with the flow. Just whatever, man. I don't care. I work at McDonald's right now. I'm eating a lot of French fries and burgers. I'm good. No thought of your future. And then we laugh at all these people who have no thought of our future. And meanwhile, as Christians, you ever think about it too? You just think about heaven, right? I just want to get to heaven, that's it. Forget growth and what the Bible says. I just want to get there. Meanwhile, I will do whatever I want here. Consider your ways. No, seriously, consider your ways. Where are you headed? What's your future going to be? Consider your ways. Jerusalem did not consider her ways. She did not consider where she was headed. She did not consider the consequences of her rebellion against God. And what happened to her? Her fall was terrible. Verse 9a. So terrible that the prophet cries out to God, "Behold my affliction," in verse 9b. And he says in 11b, "Look, O Lord, and see, for I am despised." He's crying out to God, "I'm suffering." Was there an answer? No. Because God said in his warnings, "I'm not going to answer. Don't call me. I'm not going to be home." There's no answering machine. You can't leave a message. I'm not going to answer. I warned you. Cries went unheard. And Jerusalem and her people was left abandoned. Now again, the question is, why would a loving God do that? Or how could a loving God do that? Why does God sometimes speak to us through suffering? Can it just be a nice, you know, warning? Can it be like, you know, face the wall kind of warning? Without the spanking? New parents, that's what they do, right? Face the wall. You did something wrong? Face the wall. Here's an iPad so you don't get bored. Why can't it be like that? Why does it have to be so harsh? Why does it have to be so harsh? That's the problem of human suffering. A lot of people, and even us, we can't understand it sometimes, especially when it's happening to us. So how do we solve it? What's the answer? How do we figure out, or how do we understand God through human suffering? Come back next week. We're gonna do it next week. But remember this. Remember this, though, right? Remember the warnings. Remember the consequences. Question is, how do we see God? How do we see God as loving in the midst of the consequences? Okay? We'll come back next week. We'll take that up next week. Let's all bow down our hands. Let's pray.